Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to the Mandalorian Podcast. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to a galaxy far, far away. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our coverage of the penultimate episode of the Disney Plus original series, The Mandalorian, Season 3, Episode 7.
In this podcast, we're going to give you our hot takes before discussing a scene-by-scene breakdown for Chapter 23, The Spies, followed by listener feedback and then programming notes for our upcoming schedule.
So what do you all think about this? Write in and let us know. You can send us feedback in 2 ways. Email us at starwars@thelorehounds.com or head over to our website and either use the contact form or leave a voicemail at thelorehounds.com/contact.
Next week, we're going to do a single podcast for both episode 8 and our season wrap-up. So get your feedback in as soon as possible for both topics. Normally, we record on Wednesday nights, but we're going to push our recording to Thursday, so you've got time to watch the episode and get feedback into us.
If you want to talk Star Wars with us sooner, though, join us on our Discord server, link in the show notes below.
A quick reminder about our Patreon. If you like what we're doing and want to support us directly, check us out at patreon.com/thelorehounds. For just $3 a month, you get ad-free versions of all of our podcasts, early access, bloopers, and more.
Of course, you can always get our ad-supported podcasts on our Firehose feed by searching for The Lorehounds on your podcast application of choice or using the subscription tool at thelorehounds.com.
And lastly, we would like to ask you, if you're enjoying the podcast and our content, if you could leave us a review and rating, a rating and or review, one of those two. I just want to say and or. The ratings really help us in the standings when people are searching for podcasts, and the reviews definitely help people evaluate, you know, if they want to give their time to a particular podcaster or not. We've gotten some lovely reviews that gives us very warm fuzzies, and it's actually a really big help for us. If you want to help us in one way, that's a great way to do it. So thank you all for that. John, your impressions of Episode 7, The Spies.
You know, last week we expressed some doubt over whether they can wrap up these plot lines by the end of the season. And Jon Favreau said, fuck you, here's an hour-long episode, and I'm going to do it. And I think he did a pretty good job. I mean, I don't know who directed this, but I think Favreau wrote most of the season.
Famuyiwa.
Okay, so certainly not Jon Favreau.
No.
I believe he wrote this, because I think he wrote most of the season with some input from Dave Filoni.
Yep.
And, I mean, they're doing a good job. This, you know, as much as this crammed a ton of stuff into one episode, I did not think it felt rushed. Mm-hmm. I thought that it felt well-paced. I thought that everything felt like it made sense. The fights had time to breathe. the emotional moments had time to breathe. This was, I think, some of the best writing in the series so far.
Interesting, because people were really down or mixed, I would say, on six, and then we're back on seven. And so feels right. Like you're having fun eating your cereal here. It feels like a nutritious cereal at the same time.
Sure. We might even be having some Raisin Bran.
The sugary kind, the proper kind.
Sure.
Not the budget bottom shelf stuff that's rebranded, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, the proper Raisin Brans that got sugar flakes on each little.
Right.
Little.
Yeah. What did you think, David?
Well, I'm with you there. I felt like it was a packed episode. It answered a lot of questions. It set up a lot of stuff. If you had asked me where we would be at the end of this season, I thought we would be Din and Grogu would just be getting to the Mines of Mandalore, maybe in this episode,
yep.
The penultimate.
Yep.
That they're there with a whole fleet of Mandalorians, that we've got our big protagonist revealed, revealing their plots and the grand plan that's coming together. I would have not picked that at all. And you know, one of the things that we complain a lot about in the MCU, or some people, who knows, you know, I mean, we all have different opinions, but there's a lot of, I hear a lot of comment that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there is fatigue when they're constantly setting up for the next movie, the next television show, they're laying out track for the next characters. This show is definitely doing that work. It's setting up for Ahsoka. It's setting up for the movies, but it doesn't feel forced.
Right.
It all feels natural. It all feels well connected. I don't feel like they're just shoveling another character at me because that's the next movie that they want me to watch, or that's the next television show.
Well, did you see the timeline that they've proposed for the movie?
Vaguely. The movies are going to be a while, though. It's going to be a minute before they get out here.
So I think that, I'm pretty sure it was Kathleen Kennedy said this, that the Mandoverse culmination movie, Star Wars Endgame, is 6 to 7 years out.
Right. Yeah, I did hear that. Yeah.
So we are in the Mandoverse for a while, because they're not going to let it like die and then have a movie.
Right.
They're going to want to have straight shows to then. And so I'm certain we're going to have more Ahsoka even after season one, even though it seems like they're pitching it as a miniseries. But I don't know. Rosario Dawson seems to like the role. They seem to be having fun writing it, and the fan base for the Rebels plotline is there.
Huge, yeah, it's huge.
So I think they'd be silly to not continue it.
Right. And you know, who knows, maybe they're getting gooder at the television show production stuff, so they can actually turn these things a little bit faster and be a little bit more nimble on their feet and deliver some stuff that is actually good quality. I mean, I heard somewhere on the internets, you know, God knows where I heard this, that even why am I blanking his name? This always happens to me. Obi-Wan Kenobi actor.
Ewan McGregor.
Ewan McGregor even was like, oh yeah, I wouldn't mind reprising some more, you know, Obi-Wan TV show stuff.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You know, who knows where that'll go, but I don't know. It feels like with this season, they have really strengthened their ability to write and produce this style of Star Wars. And that feels good.
I think that, too, when you look at what they're setting up with the Empire and the remnants of the Empire, where it did seem pretty ragtag at first.
Yeah.
And this idea that we are purposefully portraying ourselves as a ragtag group of remnants so that the New Republic doesn't get wind of us, and so they don't send out more patrols for us.
Right.
I really like that, because it really does, as much as I think the sequels have a lot that's not fixable, it does recontextualize, okay, here's how we got a First Order that just came out of nowhere and wiped out the New Republic Senate.
Yeah, I remember feeling that when the Force Awakens, you know, seeing Force Awakens, which, you know, for whatever its strengths and its faults are, just from a story continuum, I, as a fan, I went along with it. You know, hey, it's you know, good 77 feels and all that. But then on the back of my brain, it was like, where did these guys come from? They're, you know, Starkiller Base is a huge piece of machinery. all these forces, where did they come from? How did they, you know, become such a potent force? And regardless of what you think, what any one of us wants to think about the sequels, I like the fact that they're doing the continuity work so that our story, our overall story, feels harmonious and interconnected and not, well, we're kind of ignoring that movie because that one director did this thing or they did that thing.
Right.
It's like, no, we're going to actually straighten this stuff out. And regardless of the movie, the story is still the story. That's fine.
Right.
Palpy's rise, you know, and resurrection. That's a cool storyline in principle.
Maybe. Well, I made a face. If we were a video podcast, you'd see me make a face.
That's right.
But instead, you're here for audio, so I'll explain myself. I think that we should have freed ourselves from the Palpatine cycle for the sequel series. I think it would have been nice to have a different villain rise up. But we can't undo that, right?
No.
So this is the story that we have, so let's try to make it better. And I think that having this setup of this incompetent New Republic, the saboteurs within, and this sort of clandestine imperial operation makes a lot of sense. And I think that that's the best way to recontextualize the sequels, the same way the Clone Wars show recontextualized the prequels.
Right.
So, that being said, I think we need to talk about this episode.
Okay, good. Can I just tell you one thing?
You can.
Given that we're definitely, you know, we're on the track for Ahsoka later this year, I am going full in on Rebels.
Okay. Good choice.
My goal is to do like two episodes a night kind of thing so that I can just, I'm not going to do that, skip around. I've got to go story, you know, from front to back here. So I am doing the Japanese language track. It is helping me and I am enjoying it because those actors are nailing it. Those guys are, all the folks that they hired for that audio track are awesome. But I'm in on Rebels. I'm going to go for it.
Very cool. Yeah, so we've learned, and this was always suspected, but we've learned for sure, based on the trailer, that this is essentially a Rebels live-action sequel.
Right.
This is essentially just season 5 of Rebels in live-action. Because you have the entire... I mean, we didn't see Zeb in the trailer, but we saw him in Mando, so he's there.
Yeah, they gave us there, yeah.
Everyone else we saw in the trailer, even Ezra we saw in a hologram. So, and that Chopper, Chopper, which is Dave Filoni as Chopper.
Right.
So this is a Rebels sequel. I'm really excited for it. We didn't get enough Ahsoka in Rebels because of things that happened that I won't spoil for you now that you're watching it. And I'm just really excited to see this plot line be resolved because I was left wanting more at the end of Rebels.
Yeah.
I started Clone
the Rebel
Wars
stands
immediately
are hungry.
After Rebels because I needed more animated Star Wars. And it still didn't fill the hole. Because as much as I love Clone Wars, and I think that of the two series it has higher highs, Rebels has the best character work in all of Star Wars, I think.
Yeah, as you've said consistently. So.
Yeah. Except maybe Andor, but that's a different
that's
thing.
A different, yeah, it's a different class. That's why I'm going for Rebels, because obviously the Thrawn connection, but the Rebel stands are very vocal in their appreciation for that title.
Right.
And I think it'll do me more good to catch up on that stuff than it will be to do Clone Wars, which is a lot. How many more seasons is Clone Wars?
It's 7 seasons compared to 4. So it's and the last season of Rebels is short too.
Right. Okay.
So it's a lesser time commitment. I think that it's a more cohesive story.
Yeah.
Because the Clone Wars is almost an anthology because it's a lot of distinct stories, and sure there's an overarching, you know, conflict of, you know, the Emperor, the Chancellor creating this clone army and manipulating the Jedi, sure. But really the main story is not that present because that's already told in the prequels. Rebels is actually very self-contained. Like you can, you know, every now and then you'll get a cameo and some of them are cool and some of them are lame. But really the character work and the way that they build this family is the heart of Rebels, and I love that.
I will say that Ezra's growing on me a little bit more. His his cool guy ponytail really irked me, and the whole new wave family. I don't know what it really kind of was like. It was grating on me, but I can see the value that they're putting into it, and I know what's on the other side of this.
Right.
So I'm using that to kind of pull me through at the same time, is that I know there's bigger things coming. If I can just get through this sort of first season, which I'm through, I'm on the Siege of Lothal. I just watched those two last night. If I can pull myself through to those and get in really to the heart of it, then I know I'll be in good stead.
Yeah, and you know what? Ezra's supposed to suck at first, and honestly, all of them grow so much as characters that they're almost unrecognizable as people by the end.
That's exactly
in a good way. In a good way, and that's why when you said like, "Oh, I can't stand Ezra," well, neither could I at first, and that's kind of a testament to how good the show is. Is that it takes someone who you don't care about and makes it someone who you do by the end.
Kind of like Bo-Katan.
I have some things to say about this episode, so
we gotta
get going, man.
We are
15 minutes in, and we're just gushing about the animated series, and this is a Mandalorian podcast.
All right, so three really quick things. Din's armor really jumped out at me in this episode, you know, because we've got the covert and the armorer, and they're all in this patchwork stuff. And then we have, it's not the Night Owls per se, but I'm kind of calling them the Night Owls because they're Bo's forces. They're all in, you know, they're uniformly uniformed. And there is Din in his pure Beskar silver in this very pure, like, you know, he's of the disciples. He's wearing the white robe where everybody else has got other stuff going on. So it really jumped out at me. He is a different class of character within this pantheon.
Okay, but let's talk about this armor, because I gotta say, sitting side by side, the Children of the Watch have way better armor painting
than
the Night Owl group. I mean, no contest.
Right.
No contest at all.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, that's the way it goes, right? They were a more structured military outfit as opposed to a band of misfits brought together.
Sure.
So love the fact that they resolve the IG plot line. I think people have been like, why did they put in so much effort into the IG plot line? And obviously we got that resolution. So I just wanted to hang a hat on that, because I know a lot of people were like head scratching. What's going on with this IG thing?
Yep.
And then I really have to find out this mystery of Bo's forehead scar. Is that, and we really saw it in this episode. She's Katie Sackhoff or Bo, I don't know what the deal is, has a huge eyebrow to forehead cross scar. And I haven't seen anything on the internet about that. I haven't really looked that hard, but I'm hoping somebody out there knows and can write in.
Maybe after she gave the Darksaber to Moff Gideon.
Oh, he gave
held that Darksaber right to her.
A little too close.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking maybe we get a little flashback of that at some point.
That would be nice. That would be nice. All right. So those are my just three little things. So let's jump into the scene breakdown. So yeah, we're 45 minutes if you cut out the previously on and the end credits. And it's Rick Famuyiwa. I can never pronounce that quite properly. Podcasting does something weird to your brain and your mouth. And he's another director that is just, I think, building such a great pedigree on directing these live-action Star Wars shows. And I'm so glad. And I believe he's got this one and the next one. So he's got two back-to-back, which is pretty awesome.
Right.
So he's kicking butt. I'm really enjoying what he's got for us. So we open on Coruscant, and we see Amnesty Officer G-68, Elia Kane, meeting in secret with an Imperial probe droid. Via hologram, she reports in to Moff Gideon that the pirates on Navarro got their butts kicked by Din and Bo and the covert. Gideon is incensed.
Yeah. What did you think about the underworld of Coruscant? Because I'm always intrigued by the underworld of Coruscant, and I want more of it in the films.
Mm-hmm.
I want more of it in the series, because the whole idea of this city planet.
Right.
I mean, how could anyone govern that? And what's fascinating is that that's the seat of the government, and yet they can't even keep control of the lower levels of their own planet.
Yeah, I don't. The administration of that is crazy, and the built up nature of it, and how each little district or section would actually report in and get resources. It's
right,
seems
and
like
there's
a
thousands
wild.
Of levels.
Yeah, exactly.
There was a game actually that was in development called 1313 that was supposed to be a game about navigating that level of the Coruscant.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah, lower levels. It sounded awesome. It got canceled, and we all mourn it to this day.
Right.
But that's the idea. It's such a cool concept, and I wish it was explored more in the media.
Right. Well, this was, regardless of what you want to say on that side of things, visually, this was very Blade Runner. This was very dark and moody and rainy and neon signs. And
I'd believe you if I ever saw it.
That's the sound of me having an almost heart attack. John,
you can add it to your next list.
I know we were going to lock the old man movie list, but I think we might have to smuggle that one in because that's just a little bit too iconic include on that list. Although Conan, I see Conan is winning handily right now on the next movie poll.
No one can face off against the Barbarian.
No, it's such a good movie too. It's so fun. All right. I did notice that Kane has a TK number. Don't stormtroopers have TK numbers?
I believe so.
Yeah, she read off her number her code right to the droid was TK2755.
Right,
so.
Right, because the clone troopers are CT, and I believe the stormtroopers are TK.
TK, yeah. And then Gideon tells her to continue with your mission. So whatever she's doing, she's not done. So she's got a purpose. There's a reason for her to be there. And it seems like the way that she reported about the pirates, it sounds like to me that either the pirates were working directly for Gideon or, you know, just via a cutout in some way. But they didn't. The fact that they showed up on Navarro is not an accident. I think they were contracted or however you want to describe it. To
pirates
do that.
For
that
hire.
Intentional. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, wherever the pot of gold is biggest.
Mm. Yeah. It does seem like a hit. It does seem like an intentional hit. I'm wondering, though, if they were just goaded into it by either, you know, by either Kane or by Gideon himself.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you used to be able to go here. They're having a nice high life. That guy that used to work for, oh, yeah, he's doing great. And
however they were motivated, they were motivated for sure.
I bet
you
Gideon knows enough about these people with his intel that he could just not even pay them. He's like, I'll just save the credits.
Right. Yeah. You could have whatever you want. Navarro is yours.
Right.
Yeah, that would be a tasty morsel. I mean, there would be a number of ships there, you know, plenty of ale and other things to, you know, people to trip and bully around.
Right, yeah.
All right, we switch POVs to Gideon, who walks down a corridor of force fields past an array of guards in some super trooper armor, which we're definitely going to be talking about later. He then walks past a series of medical experimentation tanks, which we saw earlier associated with the Dark Troopers.
You have written here very Phantom Menace. I didn't get that at all, so explain.
Isn't that when they're fighting the guy with the double sabers and Qui-Gon?
Oh, with the force fields coming in between them?
Yeah.
Fight, now I get it.
Yeah.
Okay, just introduce it yourself, because I was just like, I was trying to cue you, but it was apparently, I was too awkward about it.
Well, you can leave this in as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, it read very Phantom Menace to me, that whole opening and closing of the door.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I hear you. Yeah, that was, that's the duel of the fates, right?
Yes.
We've explored that. When are we going to start our Phantom Menace rewatch? We gotta start our chronological rewatch of Star Wars.
We do. And I've been mentally preparing myself and, you know, sort of giving myself some ohms and some ahs to... You know, just take it, because now that we're so steeped into the world and the storyline, I think I can separate my, oh, this isn't entertaining, this is bad filmmaking sort of voice in my brain and just go, okay, what's the story? What are they saying here? What's happening? Why are these things happening?
Sure.
I can look at it from that objective instead of being, you know, either impressed or unimpressed by other production sides of things.
Yeah, episodes 1 and 2 are rough rides. Episode 3 is pretty good. Honestly, I stand by it. It's a genuinely pretty good movie. It's got some bad dialogue, but the plot is solid.
Yeah. This was also, when I saw the secret underground lair style corridors, I got pretty excited because I figured I was going to win some internet points on this one. We'll get there.
See, I disagree with you on something, but we're going to have to get
there
later.
We're
going to get there later.
All right, Gideon walks into a chamber where there is a holo meeting of the Shadow Council already in progress. We see 8 other ex-Imperial warlords discussing the current state of affairs. Grand Admiral Thrawn is name-dropped, and Gideon maneuvers to replace Thrawn as a leader who's not yet been seen. Gideon's request for 3 Praetorian Guard and other resources are approved so that he can deal with the Mandalorians once and for all. So we got there's a bunch of stuff to talk about in this scene.
Right. Yeah, the whole thing with Thrawn, I like that they're setting up Gideon to challenge Thrawn, because I can't wait to see Thrawn kick his ass and sort of just... I don't think Thrawn will kill him, because Thrawn's a very pragmatic person. That's his whole thing. And he's going to be like, well, this guy might be conniving, but he also is a very good leader, and I'm going to have him lead this faction.
Right.
But I love that there's actual debate over, is Thrawn really back?
Yes.
Because that's a big deal for the Empire. I mean, he was gone just before the big fights happened in the original trilogy, and then suddenly he's back?
Right. Heir to the Empire.
Right, yeah. Heir to the Empire.
Big plans happening. And it seems that Gideon definitely has some support of some of these warlords.
Right.
His arguments were sort of swaying people. Somebody even outright agreed with him at one point. So I could see that this conglomeration of ex-Imperials would be a very deadly group of people to do business with.
Right.
And kind of like a crime family or mafioso or what have you, or Yakuza style. Everybody's got their sector, and you stay in your sector. You don't go messing around. But right. At the same time, they have sort of a grand plan that they're trying to weave together.
Right. Right. The League of Evil Villains.
So, Captain Gilead Pelion?
I don't know how to pronounce that, but I believe you.
Right. So he was Thrawn's second in command from the Thrawn trilogy and was mentioned in the Rebels finale, but this is his first on-screen appearance. So I believe he was in some books and some other material.
I started the newer Thrawn trilogy.
Okay.
And it was a bit dry, to be honest. I've heard it gets better, but I just haven't returned to it. I do want to read the Legends trilogy. People say that the Legends trilogy is really like the trilogy.
Okay.
If you want to see Thrawn in action, unfortunately, it's not canon anymore.
Right. But they're still using stuff. It feels like they're pulling little threads and bits and pieces. Then we have Commandant Brendel Hux. And he, as the actor, is actually the brother of the guy who played General Hux from the sequels.
Well, that's fun.
Which makes it easier, because this is Commandant Hux in The Mandalorian is the father of Armitage Hux, who is in the sequels.
Right.
So
that's cool.
And then there's a bunch of book tie-in stuff there, too, about how the Hux family is not a very happy family, and it seems like there's a little bit of fratricide happening there and other stuff. So, I hope that didn't cause anybody any problems, but spoiler-wise. And then we have Project Necromancer. And necromancy is the practice of sorcery involving communication with the dead or returning someone to life or using the dead as a weapon.
Right.
So, we have some... Yes.
Oh, I can't do it. I can't do the emperor laugh.
Okay. Right, the cackle.
Did you see the emperor himself, Ian McDiarmid? Is that how I pronounce it? Anyway, he sat on his throne, the original throne that was on display at Star Wars Celebration.
Oh, cool.
And he did the cackle for everyone.
Oh, wow. That's nice. That's awesome. So, and of course, Praetorian Guards as opposed to elite Praetorian Guards. In fact, our friend Elisa in Amsterdam sent us some video or an audio recording that we're going to drop in at the end, talking a little bit about Praetorian Guards. So we've got a lot of tie-in stuff here to the sequels.
Cool.
All right, we get the title card then, The Spies. And I'm not really sure who the spies are. I mean, obviously we had Elia Kane, but I don't know who else is spying here.
I guess you could make a broad argument that, like, the Mandalorian scouting are spies on Mandalore. I don't know. It's a little weak.
The Shadow Council, they're not really spies per se. Yeah. So I'm not really sure how this title fits in.
They needed something to write.
Yeah. So we shift to Nevarro as we see the Mandalorian fleet arrive, led by Bo and Din. High Magistrate Greef Karga does some exposition for us, and Bo sets up the potential conflict between the two tribes.
Yeah, there's clear tension right away between the two groups. Pretty scary. Pretty scary to see because they have very big guns and big armor and big ships. I did enjoy the ship coming in and the common people being like, what the hell is this? And Greef Karga going, relax, it's just the Mandalorians.
It's just the Mandalorians.
Yeah. No, that was cool. The gift, which we have to get to next, was the best part of the scene, though.
Okay. I loved the mythosaur on the belly of the light cruiser. That was super sweet.
Good stuff.
I wonder who's guarding Plaisir 15 now. You know, who have they hired?
Jack Black in all his glory.
I hope they hired some more, you know, bodies to take care of that place. And then I just, this is a completely off the wall comment, but the combined weight of all of those ships landing on the ground, like a light cruiser actually landing, that, I don't know, maybe it's using its anti-grav and slightly hovering, but geez, when that thing came down, I was like, oh boy, that's going to leave a dent.
Yep.
All right, as the two tribes square off, the newcomers remove their helmets, ramping up the tension. The armorer diffuses the situation by welcoming them and inviting them to a feast. Greef welcomes Din back to Nevarro with a gift of booze from Coruscant and something else. So it was fun to see Paz squaring off here and getting ready to throw down with the new Mandos coming in.
Yeah, yeah. I gotta say, Jon Favreau's doing a good job voicing him.
Yeah.
It feels natural. It doesn't feel like just a placement.
And they did it. It was a nice setup for the tension that was going to happen between Paz and Wolves. Like, okay, yeah, these guys are going to fight. These guys are going to fight. Like, there's no question here.
They were itching for it.
Absolutely. But so fun to see so many Mandalorians gathered together in one big group. So that was a very cool scene. And seeing the CGI of the fleet coming in, it was just so... it really scratched that starship porn sort of itch, you know, of seeing, like, some ships cruising around and doing stuff.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
All right, back at Greef's office, we are introduced to IG-12. Greef fits Grogu into the chassis, and Grogu seems pretty comfortable. Din objects, but so does Grogu. Grogu makes a mess at the farmer's market. This isn't working for me, says Din.
yeah, the yes-no buttons are perfect for Grogu. I mean, he just... And I love how fast he is on them.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I don't think you should wear this. No. No hesitation.
Yeah. Have you seen these buttons that you can get for pets?
I have not, and now I'm scared to ask.
Yeah, so you can get this like array of like 12, 15, 20 buttons, and you can program them to say different things, and then you can teach your animal what, you know, that word is. And so there's like great TikTok videos of stuff of people's dogs asking for treats or wanting to go out and play or calling their owners really mean and obnoxious things when they say like, no, you can't go for a walk right now. And then the dog will like call the owner like the B word or something. That's like funny. That. It's really funny. But it really made me think of that, you know, this very, very intelligent creatures, but using our language in a very comical way.
Right. Well, David, it's time we take a break. And when we get back, we'll get back to our recap.
Bad baby, no squeezy.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And we're back.
So does Din feed Grogu enough? Because the way he was wolfing down the food in the market seemed like he was starving.
I wonder if that's why he hasn't grown anymore yet, is because he's just starved.
Din's being stingy yeah. with the food, yeah.
What? I gave you a pack of rations 3 days ago.
Back at the Mandalorian camp, the two tribes sit uneasily at the feast. Bo makes a speech and outlines her plan to retake Mandalore. Din and Grogu are the first to volunteer, followed by Koska Reeves and Axe Woves, and eventually the Armorer herself.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad that we finally get to see some Armorer action this season.
Mm-hmm.
It's really coming up. The team, I mean, a lot of it was just no names. But we did get a nice mix of the named characters, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And it was interesting to see Din sitting very conspicuously on the covert side, which makes sense. I mean, Axe and Koska and them, they're not his quote-unquote tribe or his people. So where's Din going to sit? But he's going to sit there next to Paz and, you know, with his covert. So,
well, you know, it's sort of like, and, you know, you might see this in real-world religious groups, too, is, you know, if one sect of that group recognizes you as full, no questions asked, part of that religion,
mm-hmm.
then you're probably going to always associate with them and rather than the other parts of the religion, right?
Right.
And yep. So Mando, I always call him Mando, but they're all Mandos now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Din, you know, he is only accepted as a full Mandalorian, no questions asked, by the covert. He explicitly was, you know, made fun of by the members of, by
I don't know what to call them.
Right.
Yeah.
The members of the League of Mandalorians. I don't know.
Right. House Krees? Not really. I don't know.
So the point is, I don't think he feels like he has full acceptance from those people.
Sure.
Whereas he certainly does have full acceptance from the covert.
Yeah. He bathes in the waters, right?
Right.
He's clean.
And I love that it's clean cut for him, right? I mean, that's what attracts so many people to mm-hmm. religion. And that's what attracts people to fundamentalism, too, is that I have a set list of rules to live my life by. And that may at times be easier when I'm looking to make a difficult decision.
Yeah, there's little decision fatigue. It's not challenging. You know what is expected of you and you know what to expect.
Yeah, now that's a huge double-edged sword, but I'm just I'm just making the case here for Din being, you know, I am fully part of the covert and nothing else.
What do you think of Bo-Katan and her leader? I mean, we kind of posited that she might not be the full leader, you know, when the Armorer says go find more Mandalorians, but she is certainly taking charge here and giving. I think if somebody had objected to her plan, there might have been a council and discussion like you would have in a normal sort of war council, but it mm-hmm. really does seem that she is the focal point of leadership now with the Armorer's implicit support. And voice, right? She can't discard the Armorer's opinions on things, but it certainly seems like she's the focal point.
You know, I mean, I think that Bo probably has a pretty romantic view of Mandalore that she grew up with.
Sure.
And Mandalore that she grew up with, which you would know if you watched the Clone Wars, David,
It's coming.
It's sort of a constitutional monarchy. Like, it had a prime minister. I don't recall if it had a legislature, but it had certainly checks and balances. It wasn't just a full, you know, anything Satine says goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that if she were going to redesign the Mandalorian government, she'd probably have something similar.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it makes sense that she would fall back to what she knows.
Right.
So the fleet jumps into Mandalore. And Bo and the recon team descend to the surface. The recon team drops and secures the LZ, and the Armorer takes her first steps back onto their home world. So yeah, I like that Paz and Woves are continuing to trade barbs here because they're slowly ratcheting up the tension of that coming conflict. And I did want to make a notice because a couple of episodes ago, I questioned how the armor made it onto the surface of Navarro. And in this scene, as they're heading off to recon the area, you can clearly see that the armorer has a cute little backpack that matches right? her outfit.
How small is that for this massive woman?
And I was worried about the little fur stole she has, like getting burned from the jetpack, you know, thrust or something. So, but she's got one. I posted a picture of it. I snapped a picture of it with my phone and I put it in our Discord because I had to, you know, clear that little detail up. So,
right. Cool.
All right. As they move out, some Mandalorian survivors show up. They admit their failure, but pledge their blasters to Lady Kryze. Around the table, Bo-Katan explains the surrender and the betrayal by the Empire and Moff Gideon. "It is always our own divisions that destroy us," says Bo.
Abso-fucking-lutely. I'm so glad she said that, though. I mean, there's a whole thing where in Rebels, now I don't want to ruin it for
here
you
we go.
Because you're watching it.
That's
there's
fine.
There's a whole thing of Rebels, Mandalorians being divided for and against the Empire. There's, you know, the whole thing of Sabine. See, we can't get these names straight.
No.
Sabine, the Rebels character, making that weapon against Mandalorians
right.
and trying to claw her way back into the graces. It's the Bo-Katan faction. She's in Rebels. And then you even have Death Watch in the Clone Wars.
Right.
That whole thing that Bo-Katan was involved in. And now we know so was the armor. And so were probably a lot of these people who were on Concordia.
Are you Death Watch? Death Watch exists no longer, says
right.
the armorer. So yeah, that was a great name drop right there.
Right. And she said, I think right after that, you know, it split into competing factions.
Right.
So this appears to tell us that this faction was a piece of Death Watch.
Right. Yeah.
And that
Children
has splintered
of the
off
Watch.
Now.
Yeah.
Right. Which is fascinating to me because Death Watch was a terrorist organization that was
right.
clearly portrayed as a villain organization in the Clone Wars.
Uh-huh.
And now they are the faction of our hero.
Right. Mention of the ISB, which ties us back to Andor. I thought that was interesting.
Right.
And I just want to shout out the two of the actors. The survivor captain is Charles Parnell. And if you ever watched The Last Ship or a whole bunch of other television, he's a very busy actor. He plays a lot of character bits. And I really was happy to see him here. And then the survivor scout was Charles Baker, a.k.a. Skinny Pete from Breaking
Bad.
No
way.
Yeah.
That's wow. Now I got to go back and watch it because that's incredible.
Yeah. I got big feels from this whole scene, and we're not even into the big part of the scene yet, but seeing the survivors and Bo's retelling of what happened, I got a lot of feels from this, and I thought it was really well played and made sense to a large degree. I loved how the captain and the scout, you know, admit their failings, but yet are still there to pledge their honor and their blasters to Lady Kryze. Yeah, it was just good. I really enjoyed this whole thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, great scene.
Feeling lots of emotions, Bo looks out over the wastelands and Din comes to her to pledge his loyalty, telling Bo that he now understands. He gives Lady Kryze his pledge of honor, saying, "I only know of this weapon what you taught me. To be honest, it means nothing to me or my people, nor does station or bloodline. What means more to me is honor. And loyalty and character. These are the reasons I serve you, Lady Kryze. Your song is not yet written." Woo, I'm getting feels. "I will serve you until it is." Bam! I was like, this is great. This is really great writing. I was so psyched.
The only problem with it is.
You're going to pop my bubble.
They made a factual error.
Oh,
their
God.
Song is written. She has two songs written.
Well played, sir. Well played. You win some internet points for that.
We'll put him post credit for this one.
That's awesome. That's awesome. well done.
There's heard a lot that, of and I was like, "How dare you, Din?"
People are wanting revisions for the song. So
I know.
You're going to have to do some more work before the end of the...
I don't know about that because I am busy. But maybe eventually, maybe for season four, we'll have some more Bo-Katan songs.
Did you get feels from this? Were you moved?
Oh, it was great. And the Lady Kreese was very well placed.
Yes, yeah.
You know, that's what I'm saying is this is the best writing I think we've seen in this show because everything felt very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Every choice of word felt like it was there for a reason.
And, you know, say what you want about episode six. One of the pieces of work that it did, though, was to give Din the perspective that Bo is royalty. Okay, yeah, he saw her on her sulky throne on her moon and, you know, in her empty chamber or whatever. But to see other nobility and other elected nobility paying deference to her and treating with her as another ruler of station, so that when Din does drop the line, you know, I serve you, Lady Kreese, it means something because Bo understands, Din now understands what that means in that world. In his world, it doesn't mean much because it's about honor, loyalty, and character, but he understands that there's a bigger world out there and having that kind of status is important, and he gives her that respect.
Right.
And I thought that was really cool. I don't know if you, did you ever see the original MASH television series?
No, I think we had a long conversation of this on Second Breakfast, actually.
Yeah, a while back.
Because of the anniversary.
There's a, I'm going to spoil a piece, so skip ahead 30 seconds if you don't.
I'm not going to watch it.
The final scene, right? So Honeycutt and Pierce, the two, you know, clowny, comical main characters who are district, you know, they're drafted into service. They're not, you know, they didn't enlist. So their attitudes toward military discipline and all of that and rank and all that kind of stuff is questionable. They're always pushing those boundaries. And the very final scene, what they do to Colonel Potter is they give him a proper military salute as the, you know, everybody's going off in their different directions. And it was so powerful and so meaningful. And it gave me the same kind of feels that I got here from Din giving Bo that respect. I respect you in many ways, and I'm going to pay you respect in this way as well. And I just thought that was classy.
Well, there's still so much time for Bo to fail us. You know what? I'm not revising the song yet. I'm waiting until after the finale.
Fair enough. I'm all in.
If you all want to stand Bo-Katan, you know, I've enjoyed her arc so far. And I think she seems to have learned something. But Bo has fooled me before.
Yeah, we'll see.
And will she fool us all again?
The Armorer and Bo confirm to take the injured survivors back to the fleet, and the Mandalorian captain says he can take them to the Great Forge. They set sail on their landship while the Armorer takes the gauntlet up. Paz and Wove fight, and Grogu steps in to make the peace.
I loved Grogu, just like, hold on, guys. Hold on.
I got an IG battle suit here. I'm going to kick both y'all's asses.
Right. And Din going, I didn't teach him that. You know, that's yeah, the that Jedi really cool. talking over there.
Ah, that's true. That's a really good point. I love that.
Will we see Luke this season? I feel like he's going to show up in episode 8.
I hope
for
not.
For some reason.
I hope not.
Okay, but look at what the show is and look at what they want to do. He's going to show up.
All right. I mean, I'm not sure what all the where all the timelines are here and there, because at some point Luke gets effed off with everything and hightails it out to the unknown regions or whatever.
I think we're well before that.
Well before,
because that. Okay, he just started the school, right?
Right,
and we're only 5 years after Endor. And so,
and those maybe sequels are 7 years now. 20, 23, 25 years.
Yeah, something like that.
Right.
And because, you know, you got to think, they didn't have a kid. Han and Leia didn't have a kid in the Battle of Endor.
Right.
So Ben has to be born. So let's say they got pregnant right afterwards. He'd be maximum 6 years old at this point.
Okay.
And I think he probably betrays at the earliest as a late teenager.
Right. Okay.
Right.
Fair enough. Great little fight scene here between Wovs and Paz. Love the vibro blade. It was very Dune like, in a particular
very
way.
Very cool.
Yeah. And love the juxtaposition of the two ships, of the gauntlet rising up through the clouds as the you know, the land sail ship thing is cruising along.
Does he have to call him a primitive?
Yeah, that was pretty dirty. That was uncalled for.
Like, okay, argue about the rules of your space chess. But do you have to goad him into like something fundamental about his personality?
I mean, you can make fun of his big gun or something like that, or right. You know, do something else. But yeah, primitive was pretty. Yeah,
his
that was
fingers
designed.
Are as fat as his gun.
Yeah, I don't know, but it was definitely designed to goad. So,
right.
All right, the recon party encounters a gigantic kaiju, and they lose their ship, but are able to escape into a cavern system down to the Great Forge. As they realize their heritage, they are attacked by Imperial troopers that we saw earlier with Gideon. They've got their own jetpacks and Beskar armor.
So this is something we've been building to for a long time. You know what? I'm going to let you claim your points first. Let's just get this out of the way.
Okay.
I know that you've got the dump truck out back. The driver's been waiting a while to dump them.
It took several, several stop. UPS drivers had to come and even bring extras from the dump truck. So, yes. So, last episode, I claimed that Gideon was secretly mining Beskar on Mandalore to create a dark trooper program, and that's where the alloy came from in the Lambda shuttle. So,
right.
Vindication. Feels so good.
Good job.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if he was fully based there until recently, just because...
Well, no, he was a prisoner of the...
calls.
He was doing...
Well, no, and also he was doing calls, and we know you can't make calls for Mandalore right now.
You know, Peter O.H., one of our lore masters, and he was on the Discord this afternoon, and he was saying he was confused about that. So that is a good question. How does he get through the atmospheric interference?
Right. But having them there would explain the bombers. At mm-hmm. Bo-Katan's fortress, her sad girl chair, earlier in the season. So
where else better to hide in general too, on a planet that is, you know, haunted, you know, doomed, too radioactive to exist on?
I think he's the one who spread this whole thing.
That is a very good point. He's probably been whispering those rumors out into the ether.
He does seem to be good at that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as he says in the Shadow Council, you know, he hears things from, you know, galaxy's end to galaxy's end. So he's probably got a pretty good network of spies.
Right.
We're lousy with kaiju this season, man. We got a lot of monster action, a lot of dino action and big monsters. We still got
one more.
No, we still got one more to go, too. Mandalore. Yeah, the Mandalore.
Oh, okay. The Mythosaur.
the Mythosaur. Yeah, the Mythosaur. Gotcha. But that was a cool looking monster for the short time that we got it, with the whole green, you know, armor plate things on the back, looking like a big glass mountain.
I just realized.
Yeah.
Grogu's going to tame the Mythosaur and fight Gideon with it and save.
You think that's what it's going to be? Is that your plan?
Well, he's test driving IG-12.
Yeah. Who is so rated for splunking.
Sure. And then he's going to go and upgrade his vehicle.
Yeah. 100%. So I couldn't help but notice before we start talking about these troopers, that these three factions of Mandalorians, the ones who never saw the light of the trees, the ones who saw the light of the trees and went back, and then the ones who never left. So I'm comparing this to the elves of Tolkien's Middle Earth. But it seemed like there's these three distinct groupings here of who was there and never left, who left, and who were never there. So I thought that was an interesting little construction.
Yeah, I think you have to flip the benefits, though.
It's true.
Because the ones who never saw him seem to be the most Mandalorian of all the Mandalorians.
That's right.
You know, the closer you get... You're having a bad time if you never left Mandalore.
Yeah, you really are. I mean, that's the first thing they ask him. They're like, are you friendly or hostile? No, they're like, do you have food? Do you have food? Can we have some food?
Well, not too worth a fight if you can't survive.
Right. So what do you think of these super troopers with their jetpacks and Beskar armor?
I mean, very cool. And great question of why they didn't do this before, because they had access to Beskar.
Yeah.
I guess just Gideon is the visionary. And I do like how later he sort of, I mean, I guess you should introduce it, but just the way he sort of says, you know, I'm going to take from all
right.
the different mm-hmm. cultures. I'm going to take the best of the best.
Which is a very Thrawn-y kind of thing to do, if I understand sure. Thrawn a little bit. I mean, he studies more, but he's certainly doing that thing of, this, you know, I'll take this bit here and I'll take that bit there and put them together.
And it's very Roman too, right? If you want to compare it to something real point. World is, we're going to conquer all these peoples and we're going to take the best parts of them. Now, we're going to do a lot of violence through this and we're going to be a terrible empire for a lot of reasons. But, you know, if you're taking the same argument that Gideon's trying to make, you know, the Romans did the same thing of, you know, conquer a civilization and be like, okay, but what do they have to offer? That's why, you
roads,
know, the Roman pantheon.
Sanitation, aqueducts.
Yeah. yeah. But,
sorry,
but even the Roman pantheon is just the Greek pantheon with different names.
Right, exactly. I wonder if, too bad Monty Python weren't still around to lampoon Star Wars. You know, what did Empire ever give us?
Hyperspace. I wish they let Weird Al do another song.
That would be good. You know, somebody call up Weird Al, tell him that John here is a bit of a musician himself. Maybe you guys can team up on a...
Yeah, we'll do a duet.
Yeah, we'll send him a mixtape. We'll do some recordings and we'll send him a tape of yours.
Should we do like a version of American Pie the way he did for episode one?
Oh we'll boy, if you could pull that off, you would own
what what movie should we do though?
I am not going to be at all helpful creative
Rogue
in
One.
This endeavor. I don't know. That would be so good.
A long, long time ago, everybody died.
Spoilers. All right. You know, I do have one criticism about this fight with the troopers. Now, obviously, these super troopers should be pretty tough. But the Mandalorians are practically born into their armor. And so they should know how to fight against this armor because they're always training with each other. And I felt like they got their butts handed to them a little bit too much at the beginning of the fight. I just, between jetpacks and knowing where the weak points are on these kinds of armor and things are, I just felt like they should have done a better job earlier on.
Well, but at the same time, it's over, Bo. I have the high ground.
We use your jetpacks, right?
Yeah, but they're already above you. You know what I mean? Like, I do think that they had the element of surprise. They had the, the aerial advantage.
Yeah, yeah.
And
more. They were a lot more.
They were not expecting a fight when they walked in there.
No.
At all. They were expecting to find a deserted mine.
Right.
A deserted forge.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I buy that they were not prepared for a fight and that they got their butts kicked. I did like that once Paz Vizsla got into his groove, he was taking advantage of all those points.
Yeah. He was definitely hit that his big gun, his BFG was certainly taking out a lot of troopers there. And Bo and some others too, I think. And Koska Reeves, you know, she seemed to be doing some pretty acrobatic, you know, combat stuff in there. So,
yeah. And like going to somebody's neck, shooting in there because that's where the gap is. Yeah. So,
exactly.
So I do think that was happening with the more
just took him a minute
warriors.
To get,
Yeah, you know, the high ground is a big advantage in Star
it's
Wars,
true.
We learn.
And surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think Wovs might find back up the fleet? There's been chatter that the armor is maybe not so good intentioned. Some people felt some dark tingles there with her.
I don't know, because why would she be leading her own people there, too? I can see if they were leading, she said, okay, well, you guys know the road. Why don't you guys go down? And feel it out and establish a perimeter. We'll be down in a minute. And let the Bo-Katan people take the brunt of it and leave them to Gideon. Okay.
But it's a mixed force.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but with the mixed force with her there, I don't know. I don't buy it.
And then if she, you know, what is she going to do back up the fleet? Because it's Bo's people that are clearly in command of the light cruiser and a vast majority of those ships.
Right.
So I'm not sure what advantage she was have, even if she was playing some game, being associated with Gideon, that seems a stretch for me. Even though they're doing some coding with the pointy bits on the helmets, it's all very Darth Maul-y kind of, you know.
Well, that was intentional because those were people who had pledged to Darth Maul.
Right. But she's got little pointy things and then Gideon's got little pointy things. So I'm not really sure. I really don't want the armorer to be a baddie in any way. I'm really pulling for this unification storyline. So if they flip it, fine. And I just hope they flip it good and flip it right.
Right.
All right, Paz gives cover to Woves, who's able to escape and try to call for reinforcements. The Mandalorian take the advantage and press the attack, but are pulled into a trap. Din is separated and disarmed. Moff Gideon reveals his plan. Ha 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 ha. Thanks to your planet's riches, I've created the next generation dark trooper suit forged from Beskar alloy. And the most impressive improvement is that it has me in it. Giancarlo Esposito here was just eating the scenery with this.
He loved it.
This, yeah, I was absolutely having a great time.
Yep. So we saw Luke destroy dark troopers before.
Yes.
Perhaps they were not made of Beskar.
No, I don't think so. I don't think those original ones might not have been. Well, they were blaster. Yeah.
I don't think they were. I don't think they were.
Okay.
But I'm wondering if Grogu, who's apparently a very powerful Force user, will be able to crunch some Beskar.
And that'd be interesting. Because he hasn't been very good on the inanimate stuff. He's a better creature speaker than he is a, you know, lever puller. Yeah.
Well, I think that's his special talent, but he still can do.
He'd still agreed.
Yeah, well, that's a special skill.
Absolutely. I thought it was a really interesting going back to my earlier point about Din's armor being sort of pure. At one point, he is pulled apart by grappling cables and into a Christ on the cross looking like figure before he's disarmed. And I just thought that was an interesting visual. I don't know that they were doing that intentionally, but that's what my brain did with that scene. But seeing Din disarmed, say that 10 times fast, was shocking, heartbreaking. I don't know if it was heartbreaking, but I was certainly, my attention was captivated. I was very captivated, and they had my attention during that whole thing. So
right. I do like that. I think last season it was Grogu captured, right? At the end of the season. Now we have Din captured at the end of the season.
Oh, good call. Good pull. That's true. Gideon prepares to complete the purge by eliminating the fleet. He demands the Darksaber from Bo, who then uses it to cut her way out, while Paz holds the door. Oh, door. Paz clears the table and then is met by three of Chekhov's, Praetorian Guard. And so ends the song of Paz Vizsla. Long may his name be remembered.
So sad. It's funny because I could have never imagined rooting for Paz Vizsla.
Never.
During Book of Boba Fett.
Never.
And they've done a great job of making me care about him, which is something that they used to praise Game of Thrones for, is turning you around on characters that you hated. And this show is actually doing a really good job, so...
Yeah, and they gave him great enemies, to clear the table and use his big gun, which was very cool to see it like heating up. And I thought maybe it was going to explode or something, but it was a nice visual detail.
Right.
But like he's exhausted after this fight, and then to go up against the Praetorian Guard who are fresh and not spent at all, they take him apart quite easily. It would have been nice to see him have a chance at them fresh. Right. But they, at the same time, they gave Paz this heroic death and then making it a tragedy and making the Praetorian Guard seem dangerous and ongoing threat that's going to reassert itself later, because who can actually defeat those guys?
Right.
So it was a really, really well wrapped up little story arc for Paz.
And I did enjoy that he brought out his wrist shield, which is definitely a part of the anti-Jedi, maneuvers that the Mandalorians have. And since they had these energy weapons, the Praetorian Guards, it was cool to see him go, all right, I know how to fight this.
Right. He was just too exhausted by that point.
Yeah. And also outnumbered. I mean, those are three skilled fighters against one guy. I know he's big, but he's not fast.
He's not that. That's tough by any estimation.
All right, David, let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll hear from our listeners. we're back. David, we've got feedback, but first we have a clip sent in from our regular contributor at this point, Alicia.
Hey, Lorehounds. Alicia from Amsterdam. Holy Mandalorian cliffhanger this week, huh? Those two sets of super troopers we got toward the end of the episode were some incredible character design. But I was especially geeking out about them because they tie together like the past and the future timelines of Star Wars with what's going on in Mando right now. So like the first ones, the black and white stormtrooper Mandos, they look like Imperial super commandos, which we first saw in Rebels. So when we saw them in Rebels, that was set in the year 2 BBY, or 2 years before the original trilogy. And Mandalorian season 3, that takes place around 11 ABY, so 11 years after the original trilogy, or 14 years after we last saw these guys. But when we saw them in Rebels, the Imperial super commandos were the Mandalorians who sided with the Empire. And they were led by a guy called Garth Saxon. And that's who the Empire sent to be Imperial Viceroy of Mandalore when they overthrew Bo. And he's also the guy that Sabine won the Darksaber from before eventually giving it back to Bo. Now, Lucasfilms, they said the designs for those Imperial Super Commandos were based on the original designs for Boba Fett from back in the 70s when they were going to make him have an all-white armor before they decided to give his armor some color. Now, I think the ones we saw today were definitely an upgrade over what we've seen yet. But yeah, the winner in the design category for me were definitely the Praetorian Guard, the red troopers with the cool capes and laser sticks. These are actually an earlier version of a group called the Elite Praetorian Guard that we saw protecting Snoke and Palpatine in The Last Jedi. So if you thought they look familiar, that's probably why. Now, The Last Jedi takes place in 34 ABY, so 23 years after the events we see playing out in Mando right now. And somehow in those 23 years, they managed to add the word elite to their title, but become slightly less cool. I guess they're compensating, or, you know, hashtag prequel problems. The Praetorian Guards, they're titled with numbers like the Inquisitors. So we've got like First Guard, Second Guard, etc. I don't know. The Empire likes numbers. But Roman history buffs probably immediately recognize the name Praetorian Guard because that was, you know, the personal guard for the Caesars or emperors of Rome. And the leader was a Praetorian prefect who was like a really powerful person. Only thing was, it was known that from time to time, the Praetorian Guard and Praetorian prefect, when they were dissatisfied, they would turn on the emperor and, kill them and replace them. Now nothing like that happened in Return of the Jedi. So I doubt they're going to use that angle here, but I definitely wouldn't mind if they did.
Well, Alicia, with another information bomb exploding in our heads, I love this idea that the super troopers were recycled designs from earlier concept art. That's very cool. Do you remember the super troopers from the Rebel stuff?
I don't. My brain has now been filled with Clone Wars stuff, and I need to rewatch Rebels before Ahsoka, honestly, because okay. It's a little hazy in my brain, and also I think I'll pick up on more now that I've watched a lot more stuff.
Right. Yeah, and the Praetorian Guard. So I remember in
The Last Jedi.
No, I'm going back to the original trilogy.
Oh, okay, okay.
What's the third?
Return of the Jedi, right? That's where you had the big throne room scene.
Yeah, yeah, with the dark, you know, the guards, and that we actually had. I think my buddy had one of those action figures. They were so cool, so mysterious. How badass could they actually be? And seeing them, you know, a version of them in action in this was really great. It was a lot of fun. I mean, it was hard to see Baz go down, but it was also kind of cool to see how deadly those guys actually could be.
Right. You know, they're doing a throne room replica, a diorama. Uh-huh. They're doing a diorama of the throne room scene in a Lego form coming out this year.
Of course they are. Of course they are.
Good times.
Yeah. All right, Alicia, thanks very much. And I think we're going to have Alicia on the season wrap portion of our next episode. If we can get our time zones lined up right, I think it would be great to have her give some opinions on the season as a whole and what she sees coming and what we've connected to in the past. So looking forward to that conversation. We will have on the episode 8 and season wrap up. But Alicia, thank you so much for all the voicemails that you've been sending us. They are very informative and super helpful.
Absolutely. Thanks, Alicia.
All right. Our next piece of feedback comes from our other favorite Star Wars and Tolkien scholar, Marilyn Arbogila. She wrote in to make a comment about armorers, because I think I said something about that a couple episodes ago, about it was cool that the armorer is this central figure to Mandalorian culture. And she says, armorers and blacksmiths are much more than just mere artisans, however skilled and important. They have a long and honorable folk history of quasi-magical abilities connected in some degree to alchemy, the magical ability to transmute matter from one form to another. This is, in some respect, what blacksmiths do. They take earth and turn it into steel. Armorers and blacksmiths protect with iron. Think of the horseshoe placed over the doorways in so many different cultures. Pratchett does a lovely take on this whole concept in Lords and Ladies. It in no way surprises me that the hearth is the center of the Mandalorian culture, and the armorer is, in a sense, a priestess of that hearth, like Hestia in Greek mythology. It's fun to see that she is also a skilled warrior and uses her hammer to do more than forge Beskar.
Yeah, very cool, Marilyn. I appreciate that you've made that distinction for us, that this was not just another, I mean, just another. These are super just important professions, another. Especially before mass production. Right. I mean, this is how people got the goods that they needed. But this was a level above that, right? This was something that was so fundamental to society that it garnered respect. And in this society where it is, you know, the armor is your identity, it's your family mm-hmm. identity, I think that it makes sense that she is so elevated in this culture.
Yeah. And I love this idea of transmutation too, taking the human body, the human spirit, the human mind, and through training and rigorous, you know, effort, that you're molding yourself into, you know, this living weapon in a way, which is valued among the, you know, the Mandalorians. And so, yeah, it makes sense. And I mean, it's just like the armorer says to Grogu, you know, that we forge ourselves into these stronger beings through this process. So yeah,
right.
Really great stuff. And thinking about Greek mythology and how and cultural anthropology and how Star Wars is able to weave all these different elements into our storytelling. It's a lot of fun.
Totally.
All right. Jesse sent in an email to StarWars@thelorehounds.com. They say, am I crazy or did Filoni and Fav miss a tremendous opportunity to connect back to the IG-11 plot thread with Din encountering the Ugnaughts in the last episode? Why didn't Din ask for the parts he needed to repair IG? Awful. LOL. Thanks, Jesse. Well, Jesse, now we know.
Yes, now we do. No need to answer that one.
No. We got the Anzellans doing the work there. And we've got now Grogu in a battle chassis that is worthy of his history and abilities. I think a lot of people were scratching their heads about IG, and so it was a nice way to bring that back and to not leave it a plot element that's, you know, on the cutting room floor.
Right.
All right. We've got Viv following up from her email last week. She sent in to StarWars@thelorehounds.com. Thank you, David. I was absolutely tickled to hear my email on the pod. Of course, the very next episode seems to have proved me wrong. Ha ha. But I'm making an internet wager. I don't think we've seen the last of this plot line. I'm still predicting that there will be further conflict over the Darksaber. Maybe the siege won't go as planned. Bo-Katan goes a little crazy, and she does still challenge Din in a moment of weakness, a la Voldemort killing Snape for control of the Elder Wand in Harry Potter. I could be totally wrong, but I have a feeling this is what they're building towards. Thanks again, Viv. Viv, I don't know. You're not batting here. That's a couple of swings.
You're 2-0, Viv. Pitch.
You're 0-2.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, look, it could still happen, technically. I'm going to say unlikely.
Yeah, unlikely. I mean,
with the Darksaber part, I mean, that could happen, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Din has pledged his undying loyalty for Lady Kreese. I think if there's a conflict, the question mark now stands over the armorer, and we have to see what resolves with that.
Right. Which would be cool, I think, if the armorer goes, all right, here's something. Here's something I'll posit.
Okay.
The armorer says, all right, thanks for assembling my army. Thanks for establishing the safe perimeter. Now that we have the kingdom all set, let's do one-on-one, Bo. Why don't we do one-on-one for the Darksaber? And then she's like, all right, I had you do the work, and now I'm going to take the crown.
That would be a smart thing to do if one were so inclined.
Right.
And you'd have to make sure that you had some edge above in that fight so that you could take them out, like a poison blade or, you know, some sort of secret dart,
I don't know. I think the armor very well could defeat Bo-Katan in a fair fight.
Them's fighting words. Well, we are talking about a fight.
I think it's possible. I don't think it's certain, but I think that she has shown herself to be a tough, very strong warrior.
Hammer and tongs versus all of Bo's belt of tricks.
I wonder, what is the hammer made of? Because Beskar is not supposed to be a weapon. But it's not a weapon. It's a tool that she happens to use as a weapon sometimes. I wonder if she's got a loophole there.
Write in if you got the over-under on the armor and bow. All right, Eric K. via the contact form at thelorehounds.com. Hey, David and John. Great podcast. Just wanted to throw a few things out there. Number one. Rebels is the best animated Star Wars series. Their characters deserve to be in live action for sure. So happy it's happening. John, I would guess that you agree with this take.
Yes, I am. I'm a big fan of Rebels. I mean, I don't know if it's my favorite. I think Clone Wars is very close in how much I love it. So I'm not going to declare either one my favorite. They're both my children.
And fair enough.
But yes, I'm very happy that the sequel is finally happening.
I'm very high on the Bad Batch, so I think of all the animated that I've, touched on and seen little bits here and there, Bad Batch has got my heart right now.
Now, wouldn't it be great if they took that Bad Batch animation and they did an original trilogy era animated series? Because there's a nice few years chunk between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back that I think is rich for some Luke and Leia adventures.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right.
And you don't have to do weird CGI because it's animated.
Right. That's true. All right. Eric continues. Dooku's lightsaber hilt was designed for Christopher Knight because he was an accomplished fencer. Old reference to one of your Andor conversations there. Interesting.
Okay. Know that. Interesting.
Good little factoid, little cocktail tidbit. I've heard that, number three, I've heard that Gina Carano's abrupt exit from the universe caused all sorts of ripples, including those Mando-themed episodes getting slotted into Book of Boba Fett, which may explain why the series got a bit jumbled. Have you heard anything about this? Also, in the age of streaming, having a bunch of intertwined series seems like a necessary evil to keep people subscribed.
You know, the Gina Carano thing, I don't know anything about. I don't know about you, David.
So no, I haven't heard any of that. That does make sense, though, because if they were going to build her out and then you take that piece out, they had to do a lot of reconfiguring. I don't know that it's true, but there is a logic there, and seeing it play out, that makes sense. So as a theory, I think it's a theory that we should keep in our minds, and if we hear more details about it, you know, we can confirm or deny it, but I don't think it's a bad theory in that regard.
And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because what's done is done. We're here. As far as the necessary evil comment, totally disagree on that one.
Because
I do think it's evil. I just don't think it's necessary. Because here's the thing. If you have a bunch of series and they reward you for watching the other ones, great. You know, if I can watch, you know, this episode, and we can have Alicia come in and say, wow, it was great to see the Praetorian Guard.
Right.
And that rewarded her for having seen other parts of the universe. But it's not like she needed to see even the original trilogy for that to make sense.
Right.
Right. You didn't need any other media. You didn't need Book of Boba Fett to enjoy that more. Or to enjoy that at all, rather.
Andor, I think, would be a great example of that, because there's probably a lot of people who are not Star Wars fans and who got into Andor because it was a cool spy story.
Right. And there were things like prequel trilogy era artifacts in Luthen's shop mm-hmm. that would reward you if you knew what they were, but were not necessary to enjoy the story. And I think that is the kind of crossover you want. Right. Is I am going to watch all of your shows because I want to, because mm-hmm. I want a more full experience. Not because I need to. I don't want to be forced to watch another show to understand the show I'm already watching.
I think that's where the MCU might be struggling a little bit.
Right.
Because they really are. It does really feel like they're forcing these things on that you're going to have to watch this series to understand that movie and such.
Right. Which was a less big problem mm-hmm. when there were fewer movies. But
right.
I mean, I kind of, a couple years ago, I tried to get into the MCU and I turned on Disney Plus and I was like, well, how do I even start this? Like, I could do the chronological thing that they have, or I could do release order, but it's just exhausting, right? How many movies mm-hmm. do I have to watch before I can understand one thing? And
right.
So basically, at this point, I come back for Spider-Man and Guardians of the Galaxy.
Mm.
Those are my, like, I will always go to see those.
Got it.
And the rest, like, I'll take it or leave it. You know, it's not bad, but they've lost me as a, you know, as a big fan, whereas I probably for the first phase I saw almost every movie.
Right. Same.
Whereas now I'm like, I don't even know how to get back into this. I'm lost.
And we really have to address the issue of pacing and how many properties are you giving us in a given year?
Right.
And then that goes into the whole streaming model question. I mean, we just are now, today, I got an email from HBO saying that it's going to be called Max now, and they're combining the Discovery and HBO and HBO Max all together. And yeah, all the streamers are struggling right now because we've sort of hit peak streaming. What does it mean? And I think we're still trying to understand it. Even when we covered Kaleidoscope at the beginning of the year, they were trying something.
I don't talk about it.
So I think we're still experimenting and understanding what streaming is going to, you know, provide us. It does certainly help, though, when I'm ready to go watch Rebels or, season one of Bad Batch. I remember last year when I started season one of Bad Batch, it was useful to have streaming because I could just call it up and go to town and I can watch at my own pace. So, yeah, I think it's a complex issue. So,
and also, you have to think, if you're listening to this podcast, you are already in the top tier of fans of this material.
Right,
you are seeking out more information. Think about the person who saw Star Wars 30 years ago and it's like, oh, there's a new Star Wars show on. I'm going to turn it on. And then you have to figure out that you need to watch a different show. It's not even like they tell you on the Mandalorian mm-hmm. feed. Mm-hmm. You have to figure out that you have to watch a different show. Most people aren't going to do that. If you're listening to a podcast, you are in the tier of fan that's going to look that up.
Right.
If you're not, a lot of people will look it up, but a lot of people won't at this point.
Yeah.
They'll just get fatigued. They'll just get confused and they'll be frustrated and they'll turn it off.
If there's not something compelling that grabs them right away, which you might have gotten with Andor to see, you know, this sort of compelling characters, you know, moving around. So
But that's my point, as you even said before, Andor is not something that you needed to see something else for.
Right.
And that's really where we're at is.
Because it had a quality storyline that stood on its own outside of the universe that it was embedded in.
Right. You shouldn't need to rely on another piece of media. Anyway.
Yeah,
this has become a long rant, and now I'm angry.
That's what we do.
So thank you very much, Eric.
All right, well, Eric's got one final point. Bold prediction that could go horribly wrong, redemption arc kill. Vader was redeemed, but sacrificed himself to save Luke. Cassian was a hustler scammer, but found purpose, and we know how that turned out. All this to say that I think they're setting Bo up next. You've immortalized her in your flaws in your song. We've seen her moping about her fortress of solitude, and we've seen her inspired by the covert. I think she brings the Mandalorians back to their home planet, check, as their leader, but Moff G reappears with support from Thrawn to take her down, check. This leads into the Ahsoka series, check, and provides time for Grogu, Din, and the Mysore posse to take top billing. Maybe no check there. Maybe in the Filoni movie or just in my silly brain. Two Force wielders in Ezra and Grogu along with space whales and a mythosaur. Sounds like it might need a movie budget. Just saying. He's not wrong in a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, yeah. The you know, I think the lightsabers are pretty easy for them at this point, although I've seen a lot of complaints about the way the lightsabers look.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, I am fully aware of what the Star Wars fandom is and how anything, anything will set them off. I saw them called the Fandom Menace the other day, and I laughed very hard.
Right.
But it, by the way, there was a lot of chatter about orange lightsabers.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say.
The red lightsabers look too orange.
Right.
And then they came out at the convention. They were like, yeah, they're orange.
Yeah, yeah.
Deal with it. So you're going to have to figure out why.
And they knew that by tweaking the color hue of a lightsaber like a couple of points over, it was going to send the fandom into a tizzy. And they knew very well what they were doing when they did that.
Right.
That was not accidental. They're aware of these things, for sure.
Yeah, I just had to stay off Twitter with the Star Wars stuff at this point, because you go on a tweet about The Mandalorian and everyone's like, this is the worst show I've ever seen in my life. I'm still watching it, though. And it's so weird.
Got to get ours. Yeah, it is. The fandom's a funny place. All right, friend of the pod, E. Hoop wrote into Star Wars at the Lorehounds. I don't want to be critical of your tech, but my audio on the pod sounds like you keep saying Doc Brown when you're clearly trying to say Commander Crudge. Maybe it's my Google Pod format. Ha ha. A couple of things I observed recently. First, both Bad Batch last episode and Mando 3 episode 5 had very significant Cloud City vibes. Bad Batch, when the Batch limps home to be betrayed by the Empire, I made the best out of a bad deal, or whatever Rhea Perlman said. Mando, obviously the opulent city with the Ugnaughts in the basement. That makes me wonder what might be coming in both cases, and it's probably not good. Bad Batch is done, and they're kind of on the run, so that's obvious, but we've got a couple more episodes of The Mandalorian to go south. Also, the bowling with pill bugs game in the last episode was very obviously reminiscent of the hedgehog croquet in Alice in Wonderland. Oh, that's a good pull.
Yeah.
From there, I start to think of Lizzo as the Queen of Hearts, and I wonder if she's going to be shouting, "Off with their heads!" in another episode. Or is Disney just sneaking in an ad for their classic content? I totally missed the Harry Potter thing with the wand rule, so thanks for covering that piece, Ed. And he attached a gif of Commander Crudge, which is Christopher Lloyd, choking Admiral Kirk in Star Trek VI, The Search for Spock. So that was the call there. Doing crossing the streams, crossing the IPs.
Yeah, crossing the stars, crossing the wars.
That's right.
Got it. As far as going south in this season, I think that it's feeling a little warm in here. We've already done that a bit.
Yeah.
Things have gone south. I think the Mandalorians are on the run. Din is captured. Good call. Good call, E-Hoop.
I was going to say, too, that... with Lizzo. Apparently, she's a huge Grogu fan, and like her socials have lots of Grogu stuff. And so the fact that they called her up was really one of those. What was the guy in Game of Thrones? Ed Sheeran. Right. Oh, I'm a fan of the show, and the showrunners get a hold of that information somehow, and then they sort of reel you in. So I think part of that, you know, and it was fun to pair her with Jack Black, so I think it was just one of those, you know, cool things that they can do because they've got big toys and big budgets, and, you know.
Well, I think you made a distinction there, though, which is that Game of Thrones was a deadly serious show that had some humor, but not that kind of humor.
Right.
Whereas I do think that the Lizzo cameo and the Jack Black cameo made sense in a Star Wars thing, because Star Wars has always been a little silly.
Yeah.
And it's okay to have a cameo now and then. That's all right.
That's right. All right, Kevin S. via the contact form at lorehounds.com. I had a random thought this Saturday morning as I sit in my jammies and enjoy my Fruity Pebbles. So, Bo-Katan fought in the Clone Wars all the way through the Empire's rule, and now it's roughly 10 ABY during the New Republic rule. How old is this lady? I think it's a good question. Yeah.
I did some Googling for you.
Oh, good.
Nobody knows. Because she doesn't have a birth year. But she was in probably her 20s-ish in the Clone Wars. So people estimate somewhere in her 40s or 50s.
Okay.
That's where we're at.
I would hope that the medical technology of that age would allow you to live a little bit longer of a lifespan. I know that at my age, I don't think I could be doing any combat roles. I mean, my daughter and her friend tried to get me to play tag with them the other day in the street, and I I was feeling it that night when I went to bed.
There you go. Yep. I know the joys of running around with small children very well from my own children.
Last feedback, Qui-Gon Jay on our Discord, link in the show notes. One issue I do have is that Bo clearly states that the atmosphere restricts outside communication, but Gideon has no problem with his group Zoom call. We did touch on this before, but I think it's an important question that we got to put a pin in.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the question is, I don't think they could have built it that fast if they were just starting to get down there. I do think there was at least an active mine down there. So I think that, and probably they were storing some ships down there too, right? Mm. They were at least having a storage unit there and a mine. And it could be that Moff Gideon was up on a ship most of the time so that he could keep in touch, and then he would shuttle down when it was necessary. And then probably he saw the Mandalorians coming, said, all right, time to go in place for my drama and my show.
Crazy theory. Are they the ones, is the secret base the ones causing the radio interference?
Oh, are they jamming comms?
Yeah, are they using the natural radiation, the current radiation around the planet and accentuating it somehow or utilizing it in some way, you know, scattering it, causing some sort of ionic radiation or something? I don't know.
I like your theory, and I'll prep your next dump truck.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. And, you know, I won on Ted Lasso, too, with Jade and Nate.
So I have some issues with that, too, but we'll get there.
I am swimming in points this week.
I'm not sure I agree with you on winning that one.
All right. Well, it feels better than the drubbing that I took at the end of The Last of Us.
Oh, sure. No, you're doing much better now.
I'm doing good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's it for our episode. Anything you want to say before we wrap things up?
No. Okay. I love the show. Let's do it. Let's keep going.
All right. Patreon shout out to all of our Lore Master patrons. We like to give you a shout out as part of your tier benefits. And again, I know we don't have any big tentpole shows going on right now. We're continuing to podcast. We'll be, you know, continuing to carry forward with what we got. We've got some cool stuff on the horizon. And, you know, there's resources involved in podcasting. And our patrons are really the best way for you, if you're interested, to support us in continuing to produce the content that we make. So to all of our patrons, thank you. To our lore masters, Samartian, Cyrus, Mark H., Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., Nick W., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Lavinia T., Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L. and Gareth C., thank you all so, so very much. John, what do we've got in April coming up?
Oh, so much still. We just put out our second breakfast for April, where we talked about eggs and raising Arizona.
Dude, I think people went crazy for eggs. We had so much conversation about eggs as a breakfast food. It was wild.
We have a couple Patreon-exclusive channels in our Discord that unlock automatically if you link your Discord account to your Patreon account and you're a patron. And that second breakfast channel, I don't think it's ever been as active as it was this weekend.
It's true.
Because everybody had an opinion on eggs, and I loved it.
It was
great to see all these different, you know, approaches to eggs, all these different opinions on eggs, and now we're trying to figure out what we're doing for next month, and everybody's got an idea.
That's right. Well, we're voting on our Old Man Movie of the Month, which is between The Black Hole, Conan the Barbarian, and Dragon Slayer. All three movies John has never seen before, but are foundational to our modern science fiction and fantasy realms. And then we're also going to have a poll, I think it's going to drop on Wednesday, to figure out what our next second breakfast topic is going to be.
Yep. And I am excited for it. Also, on the feed, we've got a new episode of The Book Nook, where you can hear us talk with Marilyn Arpakila about A Wizard of Earthsea, the second half of the book. We took some listener feedback, and we had a great conversation, as always.
John, have you started to read The Furthest Shore, the next book in the series?
I have not, and that's also not the next book, so.
What is the name? Oh, the Tomb Zwatuan. No, what am I? Silly me. Sorry. I got ahead of myself there.
That's okay.
I've started my read, but you read faster than me. I mean, you'll probably read it in like an evening's read.
We'll try. I'll try.
Your speed, even you.
I haven't been reading as much because we're doing so much podcasting. And speaking of more podcasting, we put out the Lorehounds Play Part 1 of The Last of Us Part 1, Part 1 of The Last of Us Part 1, where we break down, me and Brandon the Bard, we break down that video game. It's the 2013 video game from Naughty Dog that the show is based on. And soon, we are going to have The Last of Us Part 1, Part 2 out so that you can hear the second half of our conversation where we talk about the last half of the game. Brandon is a joy to talk with about video games. I think we talk about some aspects of the game that we didn't get to go into in the show because we tried to keep that show focused. And so I hope you'll join us there if you're a fan of video games.
Yeah, as a non-video game player myself, it was really fascinating to hear you guys work through some of the stuff. So a really very cool addition to our lineup.
Yeah, we love having Brandon around. And weekly, we have Ted Lasso and The Mandalorian. And we are just going strong on those. The Ted Lasso podcasts are super short. They are your commute to work podcast. And I hope that everyone's enjoying them because we are.
Yep, absolutely. All right, John. Well, as usual, we've gone long. But, you know, normal for us. I love that stats that you put up on our Discord server, too. The sort of average lengths of our episodes.
Oh, yeah.
So.
I made a pivot table.
Yeah, it was awesome. Check that out. Yeah, you're getting fancy with the spreadsheet action.
I know.
Well, thanks again, everyone, for tuning in. And we will catch you next week for episode 8 and our wrap-up, season wrap-up. It's all going to be one long podcast. Our friend Alicia from Amsterdam is going to join us for a little bit. Send in your feedback. We're going to delay our recording by a day so that everybody has time to see the episode and get some feedback into us. StarWars@thelorehounds.com or thelorehounds.com/contact or drop us a note on the Discord. Thanks, John, as always. And we'll see you on the Ted Lasso podcast out in a couple of days.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds and connect with us on Twitter at @thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.